Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And tonight, we're going to be studying with David Seeloff. He is the director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. You can go to the website, AskElm, it's AskElm.com. You can email David Seeloff, David@AskElm.com. And our subject tonight is about David's tomb. And this promises, this will be part one, and this really promises to be a fascinating study. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne. This is going to be an exciting few shows.
Yes, I think so, too. You've recently written an article on this, and I've been reading it, and it is very, very interesting. So I'll turn this over to you because you are the expert. So dive in, David.
Okay. Well, basically what we're going to do is cover the commentary that I wrote, and then a newsletter that I wrote dated October 1st, and then the article itself. And the article was twice as long as the usual articles that ASK publishes.
Right.
And, you know, it's so we have a lot of ground to cover, and we'll probably go off on tangents, which is just great.
Yeah.
And, you know, the aspect of discovering King David's tomb has always fascinated biblical scholars and archaeologists. And actually, there's probably no Old Testament character that has such a well-developed personality, primarily through his own writings.
Yes.
You know, the Psalms, most of the early Psalms, over half of them are written by David himself, apparently, as far as we can tell. They're attributed to him, and very likely he did write them. He shows a true greatness of character and achievement in his life, and this is brought out in 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 9. He was called David the Great by God himself. He was called great. So King David actually, as we know, had flaws that are larger than life, but they were flaws that spanned the entire range of human emotion, dealing with good and evil conduct, good and evil experiences in his life, good and evil actions, great sins and yet great compassion that he had. And yet he always had a consciousness that was striving for righteousness, even when he did wrong. He always had a conscience that would allow him to repent and come back. He was a larger-than-life figure, and yet he's one of the most detailed and most human personalities in the Bible, in the entire Bible.
Yes.
And, you know, you wonder, well, why does anyone care about King David? And the fascination with King David is because he was such a thoughtful and a meditative person, even though he was a man of action. And we have his innermost intimate thoughts about love, about life, and his love of God as set forth in his own words, preserved in the Psalms and in the narratives like Samuel and Chronicles. His writings display the full range of human emotion, and while his life shows that he was a person susceptible, just like you and me, to the prime motivators of evil in all of life, which are money, sex, and power. And he experienced the height of all of those. And, you know, he was at the pinnacle of human achievement for anyone in the physical, you know, outside of Christ himself, who did not sin. But Christ didn't achieve greatness in this world as the world usually sees it. But King David did. And he was able to express emotions about life that few others have ever matched in history. So I remember one person, and I don't really recall the source, who termed King David he called him the first modern man.
Oh my goodness.
Because he was, contrary to most ancient times, very introspective and individualistic. In ancient times, people were quite, their individuality was submerged in the community in which they lived.
Yes.
And in the Western world, it's hard for us to understand that. But in the Eastern world, and in the world of the Bible, and in tribal cultures, you are part of a community. You're not so much of an individual as you are part of an organic communal group. And David related to God one-on-one as an individual. He related to God directly, and less and less through his participation in community, because as an individual and as king, he represented the community to God to a certain extent, so that he was the community embodied as king. And he was the best king and was actually a Messiah-type figure, which means he was anointed.
Yes.
All the kings were anointed. And that's what Messiah means, is someone who's anointed. So David had an aspect of a messianic-type figure that was always looked on in Israelite history, both sacred in the biblical and also in the later Jewish writings, of being the ideal king, but also some type of a person that the Messiah would have to live up to. And indeed, we find that in Jesus Christ,
yes.
Who surpasses David in every single aspect, except he was a servant and not a ruler. King David, of course, was a ruler.
Yes.
So as the first individual, first modern man, in a sense, he actually formulated communal worship for the people of Israel in the tabernacle that he built the Ark of the Covenant when he brought it to Jerusalem. It's called the Tabernacle of David. And later, he established the worship that Solomon would conduct once the temple was built, once David died and once the temple was built. So the article that I wrote for October 2006 for the ASK website is titled "The Location and Future Discovery of King David's Tomb." Now, let me preface at the beginning that I don't know exactly where the tomb is. If I did, I would go to the Israeli government and tell them, it's right here, get your shovels, we can dig it right now.
Mm-hmm.
But we can get very, very, very close, and if God wants it to be found, it'll be found, and it could, once it's any one of the several chambers are located, it can be obtained, and we can know exactly what's in the tomb before we enter and physically walk into the tomb itself. The tomb is unopened, and the bodies are in there. And there's probably more than one body. There's probably King David, Solomon, perhaps the wives of King David, Bathsheba. And we'll get into the really exciting stuff, really exciting speculation as to what would be in that tomb. And there's some good evidence and reasons for thinking that a lot of those objects and things might be in the tomb. And it's mostly all from biblical and historical evidence that we're going to be dealing with today.
David, if they do find this tomb and they open it, that would mean also that they would have the DNA of Judah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
There is a group that, well, if you look, if you Google DNA of Levites,
mm-hmm.
just DNA and then the word Levites, you will see that the Jews feel that they have been able to identify the genetic DNA structure of all people who would perhaps be considered Levitical, or the priests, mm-hmm. the priests of the tribe of Levi. There's, I know of another group that is collecting and segregating the DNA of King David. They're trying to identify it.
Oh.
Obviously, the location of the tombs of David and the bodies would make their job a lot easier.
Yes.
But if you can do that and get to the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Levi, there's a good chance you would be able to identify the other tribes.
Right. Oh, my.
Now, this could be dangerous for someone who would want to commit genocide, because there are
yes.
DNA-specific illnesses that could be produced. But that's not in the cards. We know from the Book of Revelation that, you know, all 12 tribes will be represented at the end, at the end time. So that's not going to occur. It's not going to happen. That doesn't mean somebody might not try. But, you know, to answer your question is yes, they would be able to determine not only who is of the tribe of Judah, but they would be able to determine who is of the kingly line of David.
Right.
Jesus was a descendant of David. We know that from the genealogies.
Yes.
A lot of Jewish people keep genealogies that go way back. Dr. Martin used to discuss his friend and colleague, he worked for Dr. Benjamin Mazar, Professor Benjamin Mazar, who conducted the dig at the southern and southwestern portion of the Haram Esh-Sharif. Well, Benjamin Mazar, Professor Mazar, one of the founders of Hebrew University, was able to work his genealogy all the way back to King David, and he felt that he was of the Davidic line. Whether some of those genealogy parts are false or interpreted or suppositional, I don't know. I can't judge. But it would be very helpful to have the DNA, which, if the teeth are preserved, you would be able to get the mitochondrial DNA that you would need. It might not be possible. It might be too long. 2,000, 3,000 years might be too long. It depends on the state of the preservation of the bodies.
Right.
But if the bodies are in reasonably good shape and or preserved, they might even be preserved to the same extent that the Egyptian mummies were preserved. If David was the important king and they embalmed his body, it's quite possible that the state of preservation could be quite good.
Yeah.
Now, then you get to the problem of, well, is this desecration? Some of the rabbinical people, the rabbis, would say it is. The Muslims might have some objection to that also, because David and Solomon are two of the 12 prophets of Islam, on same equal rank as Jesus and Muhammad.
According to the Islamics?
Yes, to the Muslims. So that this would be a major find,
mm-hmm.
a major, major find. It would be as if a prophet has come back to speak to them, if there would be writings inside the tomb.
Oh, my.
This could have a major impact on Middle East peace.
Yes, it sure could.
And it could change Islam for the better from one of their own prophets. They could not deny that it's genuine.
Right.
And they could not deny that he's a prophet, because it's stated right up front in their own writing.
Oh my.
So this could have a tremendous impact and on a lot of things. It would become a major source of pilgrimage for Muslims. It would be obviously become a major source of pilgrimage and visitation for Jews, and also for Christians.
Yes.
It would be a multi-billion dollar business.
Oh, my goodness.
To enter the tombs of King David and rehearse his life, because we will know more about him, if there's an unopened tomb, than any ancient figure, period, and this is for, well, you know, this is 1000 BC, and, you know, what are we talking about in the timeline here? We're talking of, oh, roughly, let's see, when was Isaiah? Isaiah started, oh, roughly about middle 700 BC, 300 years before Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. You know, this is just like...
The implications are unbelievable.
Absolutely.
And if Solomon's there, well, you know, we'll get into what might be in the tomb, and it's quite exciting and speculative, but also exciting as to what might be in the tomb. So, you know, we're going to cover a lot of ground, but it's going to take us a while. So this will be at least 3 shows, and maybe more.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, my gosh.
So the article for the October 2006 on the ASK website is the location and future discovery of King David's tomb. And one of the keys to the location of King David's tomb is the concept that the Hebrew word house or beit can, upon occasion, mean tomb or sepulcher.
Right.
When the context allows that meaning. Mm-hmm. In fact, when the context demands that meaning. The word house in the Bible denotes a place. It means one of two things in general. It can denote a place, a location, a building or something, but something that has a place, and or it can mean a group of people. But the word house always has the concept of security within that place or within that group of people. Security is a prime concept, not safety so much, but, you know, when you say house or home, you have a feeling of this is where you expect to be secure and safe and where your loved ones and your familiarity with life is at a maximum. And house also, in terms of tomb, also has that aspect of place and a dwelling. It separates you from the outside world, privacy and safety.
Right.
When house refers to a group of people, it's comprised usually of biological family and friends, and it also denotes a separation from the outside world, us versus them.
Mm-hmm.
House could mean tomb in some context, and King David came to understand that his tomb, which as we'll see is provided by God himself, would be a place of security for his body to be placed until his personal resurrection from the dead. And, you know, the nature of what happens to the body really doesn't matter. The body might not be touched, but what I'm actually interested in is the writings and the artifacts and the other elements that might be in that tomb.
That's right. Oh, this is just...
And the reality of David being there, and I personally believe that the tomb would be self-identifying. For example, King Tut's tomb was self-identifying. It said that this is, you know, the tomb of King Tut, and you know, had all sorts of things all about him and telling about him and identifying him and everything else. So there was no doubt that that was King Tut's tomb.
Right.
Likewise, there will be no doubt once we enter that tomb that this is David's tomb chamber. This one is Bathsheba's. Or maybe David and Bathsheba will be buried together. I don't know. Apparently he was her favorite wife. Or Solomon might have a separate chamber with or without his wives. I don't know. We don't know about the wives and family. We'll get into this a little bit later. But David looked to the future in regard to the resurrection from the dead, and we'll see how he felt about that initially and how he came to understand and accept what God had in mind. Now, much of what King David wrote both in speeches that we have quoted in the scriptures and what he wrote in the Psalms, was prophetic. And many of the prophecies, of course, that David made had their fulfillment in Christ, but many of those prophecies had reference to David first, and they describe what David was experiencing in his own life and what would come after. For example, when Christ cried out to God just before he died, when he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? In Mark chapter 15, verse 34, it was King David who first felt that way and applied those words to himself first. Psalm 22, verses 1 and 2, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me and from the words of my roaring? Oh my God, I cry in the daytime, but you hear not. And in the night season, I am not silent. Now, God later on in the psalm and later on in the Psalms did respond to David, and David acknowledges that. But at that moment, David was wondering, God, where are you? Where are you in my life? And so many people in your audience and around the world feel that way.
Oh, yes, they do. Yes.
They feel forsaken by God himself.
Yes.
And for most people, God is actually absent, and he's an absentee father.
Yeah.
And but David expressed this in such a powerful way that this exactly described how Christ felt on the cross at the moment of his death. When Jesus quoted that short phrase, he had the entire Psalm 22 in mind because it expressed his deep, deep anguish and abandonment by God at that moment, just like David felt. And to be sure, King David was rescued, according to later Psalms and according to the histories. But Jesus was not rescued. He died and was resurrected. David was rescued out of that event of Psalm 22, but he later died and is still awaiting resurrection from the dead. Now, the discovery of the tomb of King David will cause a revolution in the world. The discovery does not fit any prophetic scenario of any biblical scholar or student of prophecy, not even anything that I've thought of. Nobody has seen how this fits into any prophetic scenario. There is no direct prophecy that I've been able to discover that even hints that the discovery of David's tomb will have any impact at all, except in Zechariah. Now, I need to qualify that. Although I do believe that it will have a direct impact on the world if the background information about what might be in the tomb actually is the case. So, we're going to get into things now, and feel free to disagree if you want, but engage with what I'm covering here and learn for yourself whether interest in King David of Israel shall come alive again when God allows it and maintains that it should be done. Now, I'm going to get into the newsletter now and talk about the newsletter is a two-page, usually a two-page article that I write. Most of the articles that we have on the ASK website are by Dr. Ernest L. Martin, and then I write a two-page newsletter after I've edited and for space and also for clarity. What Dr. Martin has come up with, either from a video, an audio tape or written material. But this month, this is all by me, and this article this month is double the normal size. And ordinarily, I would split an article into two parts, but I felt this was so important that I wanted to give it in a single dose for readers and Of course, we'll cover it in a number of shows. And this article represents my understanding and analysis of the evidence relating to the site of King David's tomb, based on research that I presented to several groups over several years. And until now, that information has been private, but not secret by any means. I mean, I've given it publicly to Biblical Archaeology Society group in Los Angeles, and other places. But some of the research presented here is unique to me, such as the aspect that a house in Hebrew can mean a tomb, which is confirmed by the work of Professor Lyle Esslinger up in Canada, the information about the pattern of the temple, the relevance of Ezekiel chapter 43 to the subject of the graves of the kings of Judah, and the passages in Zechariah which relate to the house of David, the phrase house of David, in the last three chapters of the book of Zechariah. And as you'll see, the information that we deal with comes from established biblical, Jewish, and historical sources. And I also rely on previous articles that I wrote surrounding the subject of David's tomb. For example, an article that I wrote called The House of David. We've covered that material on a previous show. You know, this House of David material is covered a little bit in this article on the location of the Tomb of David, but just because I don't want to depend on people going back to it, plus it's directly relevant to the location of the tomb. Even more important, this information incorporates the material by Dr. Ernest L. Martin regarding the temple evidence. Now, Dr. Martin discovered a considerable amount of evidence in which he wrote a book titled, you know, The Temples That Jerusalem Forgot. And it's available at the ASK website. It was published in the year 2000. And during that time, he found out that the temples in Jerusalem were all built on the single location, which was not on the Haram es-Sharif, but was a third of a mile south, immediately west and above the Gihon Springs, up above the hill, so that where the Dome of the Rock is today is not the location of the temple, but is the location of the remains of Fortress Antonia. This has tremendous implications for peace between Muslims and the State of Israel, simply because if the Jews could come to understand that the Dome of the Rock is not on the site of the Temple of the Jews, the Jews would give up claim to that piece of land, and the Muslims would celebrate it and appreciate the Jews for their brilliance, and the Muslims would reciprocate with kindness to the Jews for their religious understanding. Furthermore, if the Jews would give up claim to the Haram es-Sharif, which is holy ground to Muslims, because of the Mosque of Omar, as well as the Dome of the Rock, is a shrine to Muslim faith. If the Jews would give up the claim to the Haram es-Sharif as sacred ground to Jews, they could rebuild the temple on the correct location or somewhere else. Dr. Martin had a view that the next temple would be built on the Mount of Olives, but it doesn't matter. It's all within a proper territory. In any case, I've had Muslims tell me that the Saudis, as well as Muslims from around the world, would help the Jews rebuild the temple if they would build it somewhere other than the Dome of the Rock and other than the Haram Sharif.
That's amazing. I've never heard that.
Yes.
Wow.
Well, that's because very few, I mean, most Jews have an emotional reaction when you propose that the temple is not on that Haram Sharif. Now, there's three different theories as to where the temple is on that Haram Sharif, and they all contradict each other. Some think it's on the center, right under the, you know, where the Dome of the Rock was.
Yes.
Some think it's north of that location. Some think it's south of that location. But all of them think it was on the Haram Sharif. But Dr. Martin's research, developed through reading, careful reading of scripture and historical records, particularly Josephus, came to understand that it was nowhere near that piece of land, that it was south and above the Gihon Springs, south of the Haram, above and west of the Gihon Springs. The Gihon Springs is the only source of water within a five-mile radius.
Yeah, and now, the temples had to be built, they had to have running water, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It had to be what's called living water.
Okay.
And that water had to be flowing. It didn't have to flow constantly, but cistern water would not suffice.
Right.
As a matter of fact, the Jews ran into trouble during the time of Jeremiah. Let me bring up that verse. Yeah. And cistern water was actually rejected by God specifically in Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 13. It says, "For my people," says Jeremiah, "have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewn them out cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water." Now, if nothing else, this single verse says that cisterns are grossly inferior to living water.
Right.
And we've we've covered some of this material before about the location of the temple. But the tombs of David and Solomon are located immediately the other side of a wall from the southern wall of the temple. That's why the location of the temple is important. Because if you can have an idea of where that wall is, then you have an immediate idea where the location of the tombs of David and Solomon are. So it's important to understand that if the temples are not on the Haram, that's why no one has been able to locate the tombs of David and Solomon, simply because they've had the wrong location of the temple.
They've been digging in the wrong spot.
Right. And if the tombs would have been, if the Haram HaSharif would have been the location of the temple sanctuary, then, as a matter of fact, where Dr. Benjamin Mazar was digging would have been the correct location to look for the tombs. South of that southern wall, toward the western area, the western portion of the southern wall of the Haram HaSharif, would have been where the tombs of David were, and that's indeed where the tombs of David are. They are to the south of the southern wall of the outer sanctuary of the temple. But there's no direct evidence that Benjamin Mazar or anyone else, not his daughter Elat Mazar or Ronnie Reich or the others, archaeologists, were ever specifically looking for David's tomb. But I wonder if they didn't think they were in the right area. And where I propose that the tombs of David are actually not out of bounds of where archaeologists had thought in the general area where they were indeed located. So, this is not out of bounds in terms of where archaeologists had thought that the tombs might be.
Well, David,
go ahead.
Have any of these archaeologists used this, what is it called, ground-penetrating radar or something like that? I mean, it seems that if they would use that and really scan these areas, like you said, this one man figured he knew where it was and he was very close to it. It seems to me that they could find it.
There are severe limitations to ground scan radar.
Okay.
They only go down a few feet. I don't think more than 10.
Oh, my.
And this thing is, like, might be over 200 feet in solid rock.
Well.
Way beyond the capabilities of...
we've got military satellite stuff that can go down and penetrate. Even from satellite, don't we?
Theoretically, yes. And I've talked to some people who have access to that, but this hasn't caught anyone's interest yet. Let me put it that way.
I'll be darned.
I've talked to people who know people who can redirect the satellites.
Yes.
But it's very expensive, and it has to be a very important reason.
Yes. Well, this is a very important reason.
Okay. This is, but you'd have to convince people. Now, whether they have the capabilities to do that, don't know yet. Whether there's the capability to, you know, they can find seams of copper and gold and certain depths. With a certain degree of reliability.
Mm-hmm.
There's a good reason to believe there's a large quantity of gold, tremendous quantity of gold, in the tomb.
Oh, my.
And that alone would tell you if you're in the right spot.
Sure.
And we'll get into how we would verify. Once you have a location, say, within 50 square yards, you can get right into the chamber without doing a major, without being intrusive, and we'll get into that.
Okay.
But it's really quite interesting and fascinating of what can be done, but you've got to be a little bit more precise than we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also the difficulty, there's people at the top of the hill where you might want to do some of this work, and so you have to be, to a certain extent, non-intrusive.
Right.
And also you're dealing with a slope of some 60 degrees, so you might have to literally dig a terrace just to get the equipment to the midpoint of the hill, unless you can do it directly on the, you know, on a 60-degree angle. It's very extreme.
Yes.
And very difficult to work with. Now, you can dig terraces for stable platforms, but, you know, that all takes time, but... Once we know where it is, then it's just an engineering problem. It's not a, you know, technologically, it's not a difficulty at all. So, you know, and I think we've thought through a lot of these things, and we have archaeologists ready to go, people that some in your audience might know, but I'm not going to mention names just for their sake, because they're not going to commit themselves until we locate them.
Right, right.
And I don't blame them. But we have interesting contacts, and we're ready to go to the Israeli Antiquities Authority if we can get a precise location, and then we can move with the help of the large institutions. This will be a big deal, and everybody would want to be involved, and the best people would want to be involved, and everybody would get happy on this thing, let me put it this way, career-wise. This would be the biggest archaeological find in the history of the world.
Ever.
This would make King Tut look like a nobody. People would forget about King Tut, frankly, with the finding of King David's tomb. So, but it's all hinges, as we'll get into the evidence, it all hinges on the location, correct location of the temples in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And without it, in my view, it's impossible to find the site of David's tomb. Now, in 1995, Dr. Ernest Martin began his groundbreaking research into the location of the Jerusalem temples. And the evidence he developed resulted in his book, The Temples That Jerusalem Forgot. In the same year, a friend of mine and Dr. Martin's by the name of Professor George Wesley Buchanan, a Hebrew scholar of first note, began his research into the same topic and approached and came to the same conclusions as Dr. Martin, but from an entirely different point of view and perspective. It's really one of those serendipitous things. Dr. Martin and Professor Buchanan did not discuss their findings with each other until actually sometime in the year 2000 or 2001. And as luck would have it, I was invited by Dr. Martin to a conference to attend with him, the Society for Biblical Literature, and there I met Professor Buchanan for the first time, not knowing at the time that Buchanan's research, some of which we published on the ASK website, you know, dovetailed Dr. Martin's research also. And Professor Buchanan is writing his own book on the subject of the location of the temple. And that'll be coming out in, and his articles are on the temple update index page. At the same time, and by the way, Dr. Buchanan is extremely gracious with his acknowledgement of Dr. Martin's contribution to the subject. In 1995 also, a researcher by the name of Gary Arvidson began his research into the Tomb of David, and his first book on the subject appeared in the year 2001, and it's titled In Search of King David's Lost Tomb and Treasure. The second edition was published in 2002. And this is also an excellent book with tremendous background material about King David and his collection of the treasure that we believe is in the tomb. But believe me, we're not treasure hunting. I'm interested in the written materials. But Gary Arvidson has done tremendous work in this field also. Arvidson also incorporates Dr. Martin's research into his findings, and he's also writing his own book regarding the location of the Tomb of David. And my purpose in mentioning this is not to focus on the coincidence that Martin, Buchanan, and Arvidson began their work in 95, but that a lot of work over the past decade has actually been done on this subject, on the temple as well as David's tomb. And I personally believe that Dr. Martin's temple research will eventually have a tremendous impact on the world, perhaps through the location of the tombs of David, which will validate the correct location of the temples. We'll be able to, let me put it this way, we'll be able to find the tombs because of the correct location of the temple, but the location of the tombs will validate that the temples were actually where Dr. Martin said they were, beyond doubt.
Right.
And this will lead to peace in the region, in Jerusalem, in the region, and there will be great rejoicing, and there might even be some prophetic aspects as a result of this, which will lead to some other great occurrences to happen in the future. So I'm not focusing on the coincidence, but that a lot of work has been done and that it should, I believe, will lead to a tremendous discovery, the greatest that can be imagined, this side of the resurrection, frankly. And that it can now be determined simply and accurately where the tombs of David and Solomon are located. And God willing, the tombs will be available to the world, as the prophecies seem to indicate where the location is. Now, there's no prophecies that the tombs will be found, but there's definitely prophecies that relate to, that give us hints to the location. That's what I mean by referring to the prophecies. Now, over the years, I've spoken with archaeologists and scholars and rabbis in Europe and in Israel regarding the temple and the tomb information. And some have rejected the research, of course, but some have been in awe of finally understanding that of what were previously rather obscure biblical texts. one PhD archaeologist is writing a novel incorporating Dr. Martin's evidence as a major explanatory portion of the story, of the story of the novel. Another archaeologist, a keen analyst and critic of archaeologist Kathleen Kenyon's work, said when I gave her a combined presentation about the temple and the tomb, she said to me, "Why hasn't anyone put this information together before?" I mean, it seemed so obvious to her when I showed it to her. To her, the chain of evidence seemed obvious once it was set out in front of her. And that's what I've tried to do in this article, and that there's loose ends that require further work, analysis, and understanding. But, you know, that's what research is all about, and other people will, you know, but the word is getting out there. There was a time in which one evangelical archaeologist who wrote about the temple, he has some videotapes about the temple. One year he just totally poo-pooed the entire idea of the, you know, that the temples could be located somewhere else and that the tombs might be located in relation to the temple. The next year he was very, very friendly and said, you know, a lot of people are talking about this here, and I hadn't even made any presentations to that group, but word is getting around. And information is being communicated by word of mouth,
right,
of which your show is part and parcel of that. So, you know, let's get into the article itself, and for a little bit until we change tapes here, the location and future discovery of King David's tomb. The location of the tombs of King David and his family can be easily understood once the proper site of the temples is taken into account, as I said. If the biblical and historical evidence is correctly understood, and I believe it is now, then what those tombs could contain could change the world and lead millions of people in a short period of time to accept Jesus Christ as their Messiah, starting from Jerusalem.
Wow.
Exactly like it started. Yes. Remember in Acts where thousands were converted in one day?
Yes.
If you read Zechariah 12, 13, and 14, that's predicted to happen again in the future. And in Zechariah 12, 13, and 14, there is a relationship between the house of David, which I maintain refers to the tombs, and them viewing him whom they have pierced.
Yes.
There's a relationship there. If we're wrong that the house of David does not mean the tombs, but means the population group of, you know, the descendants of David, you'll see that those prophecies don't quite make sense. But if you look at it as a physical location, referring to the tombs, we'll see as we develop this, as we cover those verses, how the information, something about the house of David, could lead people from David to Jesus, their Messiah, starting from Jerusalem, and the Jews will pick up on this, and they will teach the Gentiles about God, way beyond any capability of the Gentiles, even the evangelical missionaries and evangelists. It's the mission of the Jews. Let me cover this quickly. The Jews were separated by God for two reasons. They were not separated because they are special. They are special only because they are separated by God. And they are separated for two reasons. One reason is to preserve the Word of God. And the second reason, which they've done with the Old Testament, and we'll see if they've done it correctly. And the second reason is to be a kingdom of priests. The entire nation of Israel and Judah, together, Israel, is to teach the world about God. And that will start. It will be fulfilled during the millennium, but it will start before the millennium, before the second coming of Christ. And what the Jews and the Israel rejected in the book of Acts, they will accept before the second coming. And it will start just like in the first century, it will start from Jerusalem.
They're not, they are very intelligent people, David, and it is unfortunate that, you know, they have their problems in the political sense with their rabbis, just like the Christians have with their ministers and preachers.
Right, absolutely. Yes.
And, you know,
in every aspect.
Yes.
And I know what you mean,
yeah.
But it's, you know, you deal with the, like I said, the three prime motivators to evil, money, sex, and power.
Yes.
It affects them as well as every, you know, their religious leaders as well as ours.
Yeah.
But once you get them fired up, they are a powerful motivating and teaching force for good.
Yes.
If their object for teaching is correct.
Well, we have some messianic rabbis out there that are doing wonders right
yes.
now.
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but unfortunately, in the Jewish population themselves, the ones in America that are teaching about religion and ethics
mm-hmm.
are the talk show hosts, Michael Medved, Dennis Prager. Not everyone can get all of those, but talk show host Michael Medved and Dennis Prager and the counselor, the lady counselor, who is she? I can't think of her name now, but she's a Jewish convert and well accepted. I think her father was Jewish. And those three people are doing more to teach morality and ethics. Laura Schlesinger.
Yes.
Are doing more to teach morality and ethics than any rabbi I have ever seen or heard.
You've got a good point.
And this is nothing to take away from the rabbis. But if a Jewish person wants to feel fulfilled, I guarantee they will have, it's fine to they take care of their own community, and they do par excellence, better than any people group takes care of their own.
Mm-hmm.
But if they want to be fulfilled, and they don't even have to be Messianic Jews, unfortunately a lot of Messianic rabbis are not even Jewish, but that's a different issue. They should teach the Gentiles about God.
Right.
They were evangelizing. The Pharisees were evangelizing in the first century. That's why Paul was able to go to the synagogues and talk to the Gentiles. All those Gentiles had previous that were in the synagogues that Paul taught at were previously brought in by the Pharisees, you know, years before, because the Pharisees went out and taught people what was the true religion at that time, fortunately corrupted, but still a little bit better than certainly paganism, and certainly more true. So, it's a marvelous situation. Once they get fired up for the truth, there's just no stopping them.
There's a lot of people. I know a lot of our listeners, my goodness, David, are really seekers of the truth. They want to hear the truth. You know, no more sugar-coated stuff.
Yeah, and they're desperate for good information.
Right. Yes, reliable, factual. Yes, yes.
Now, in Dr. Martin, Ernest Martin, in his book, the temples that Jerusalem forgot. He actually noted the correct location of the temples on page 336 of his book. He said, quote, "Particularly notice that at the time of Nehemiah, the sepulchres of David and many other early kings of Judah were located at the base of the stairs that went down into the Kedron Valley from the city of David. And they were positioned alongside a pool that was fed by the waters of a conduit from the Gihon Spring. These sepulchres in Nehemiah's time were positioned not far south of the Gihon Spring, over which the temple then stood. In the earlier period, from David to Nehemiah, it was common to place the tombs of distinguished persons, especially kings, outside the temple, but not far away. They were certainly not buried far to the north, near the Dome of the Rock," end quote. Dr. Martin was exactly correct in his assessment. However, later in chapter 24 of his book, Dr. Martin shows that in the time of Simon the Hasmonean, all the buildings on the top of Mount Zion, including the temple rebuilt by Zerubbabel after the exile returned from Babylon, all the buildings were demolished and their function was transferred to different locations. The hill itself that the original temple stood on was cut down to bedrock, and an enlarged temple was reconstructed on the original site. This is all historical. Mm-hmm. And it expanded to the north and to the west. Right. Now, Dr. Martin goes on to state that Simon's transfer of structures included the sepulchres of David, and in this he was mistaken. He thought at the time that the sepulchres of David comprised an above-ground structure. And this is in page 343 to 344 of his book, Temples that Jerusalem Forgot. However, as we'll see, the sepulchres of David, the tombs of David, were underground. They were not above ground. This might be true that there was some sort of structure at the entrance of the sepulchres, and that it was, but this is not true because the underground structures of the sepulchres of David were in bedrock. You couldn't move them. Perhaps you could have moved the bodies, and I'm not quite clear if before he died Dr. Martin thought that was the case, but there's no way that you could move the sepulchre itself because it was a natural cave series of cave structures and chambers, mm-hmm. literally built by God. And I maintain that they did not move them, and as we'll see from the New Testament and post-New Testament Jewish writings, the tombs were still there, untouched. And
did they know whose tombs they were?
Yes.
Okay.
As we'll see, Peter himself talks about that at Pentecost. But the sepulchres of David, the underground structures, the bodies weren't moved, and we know this. While the sepulchres of the other kings of Judah were indeed moved, the sepulchres of David, Solomon, and others were not transferred. They remained in their original location, but they're inaccessible to the world, hopefully until the near future. Then they'll be accessible to us, I hope.
Oh, I want to be there. I have to be there. Recording all the murmurs and the oohs and the oh my gosh.
Oh yeah. No, we would definitely, you remember Geraldo Rivera wanting to go into the gangster's tomb or the vault. Well,
yeah.
This would be able to be done on live television. But we would already know what's in there, and I'll describe that process as when we come to it.
Okay.
So, so there is one unchanged foundational wall of the temple sanctuary. Well, let me back. Yeah. there's substantial biblical and historical evidence that can now show a more precise location of the unopened tombs of King David and his immediate family in relation to one unchanged foundational wall of the temple sanctuary above and west of the Gihon Springs. This wall did not change position throughout the various temple reconstructions after the destruction of the original Solomonic Temple. This wall was used in the reconstruction of the temple by Zerubbabel after the return of the people from Babylon. This same wall was used again in the later enlargement during the time of Simon the Hasmonean, after he cut down the hill to hillside. Now, if you're going to build a massive multiple-story, 20-story structure like this Temple of Solomon may have been, built on the hillside, you've got to have a strong foundation in the bedrock to support the weight of stones. Now, how do you do that when the bedrock itself is on an angle and on a slant? Well, you cut stair steps into the bedrock. And those, what I maintain is that the same stair steps were used in each reconstruction of the temple for that southern wall. The Jewish historian Josephus specifically states that during the time of Simon the Hasmonean, the walls of the temple was expanded to the north and to the west. And during the time of Herod, it was again expanded to the north and to the west, and to the east to encompass the springs, but not to the south. Now, why? Because the tombs of David were there, and you cannot build the temple over the tombs of David.
Right.
So they reused that southern wall, and so those stair step patterns should still be in the cuttings of the, perhaps, I don't know, there's been substantial earthquakes. There was a substantial earthquake during the time of King Herod before Christ was born that killed 30,000 people in Jerusalem. And then Herod initiated a rebuilding program to rebuild the city.
And then there was a huge earthquake during at the crucifixion also.
Right, and also at the resurrection.
Yes.
So, and actually Dr. Martin relates in another book that he has written called The Secrets of Golgotha, that the earthquake that occurred at the crucifixion actually has a historical mention in the writings of the Jews in the Talmud, and the and where the meeting place, hello?
Yes.
Yeah, there the meeting place of the Sanhedrin, the lintel broke in the ceiling. It was a stone lintel, and it broke in the ceiling and all along, and that building, after Jesus was judged, could no longer be used ever again. It seems that once the judgment of Christ took place, the Sanhedrin could never meet there again.
I did not know that. That is very interesting, David.
So that, and also at the time of Jesus' crucifixion, the lintel over the temple also broke, which may have caused the veil to split in two.
Right.
And of course, they fixed, but they didn't fix the Sanhedrin meeting place. So there's a lot that goes on in history that's really pretty interesting.
Boy, you're not kidding. Wow. This is, oh, gee.
So the enlargements of the temple did not expand to the south, but only to the west and the north. So the research by Dr. Martin provides an important framework for additional evidence leading directly to the location of the tombs of King David of Israel. In turn, as I mentioned before, the discovery of the tombs will totally validate Dr. Martin's evidence beyond question, and the bodies are likely to be in the tombs waiting to be discovered, along with astonishing artifacts, and most important of all, written documents.
Right.
And it's my understanding and belief that these written documents, along with other artifacts, may initiate a period of rediscovery and presentation of the truths of Scripture to the world, leading to the restitution of all things that Peter talks about in Acts 3, chapter 3, verse 21. That's what he's referring to, and Peter expected that to occur in his day. And it started out good, but God didn't want that fulfilled until a later time.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Now, toward the end of this presentation, I'll describe the writings and the artifacts that I think are reasonably could be considered to be within those tombs, and you're going to be amazed. But keep in mind that at present it's pure speculation about what might be in the tomb, although we're going to have a good idea. Before the tomb is ever entered, we'll be able to go down with a camera and take a look exactly and see and be able to literally create a computer model, you know, whether there's tablets or whether there's stuff, we'll be able to see. And this tomb apparently has been unopened for 3,000 years. And it will be unbelievable. So, you know, keep in mind that at present it's speculation, but once it's opened, then we'll, you know, what might be in the tomb, although it is a speculation informed by intriguing historical references.
Well, you know, for you to put this together and Dr. Martin to put this together, David, God has got to have a hand in that.
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
The Holy Spirit has to be involved in this, and it's obvious that the Holy Spirit was very much involved with Dr. Martin as well as yourself.
And all to God's glory, believe
yes.
me. I know that's how he felt, and
yes.
that's what we're looking to do. In terms of human praise, believe me, there would be enough to go around for everybody. And to a certain extent, we would hand this over, anything that we know, we would be handing it over to the professional archaeologists
right.
and geologists and hydrologists, because there's water in the area and you want to make sure that, you know, things are preserved. And
nothing is covered up or hidden.
Right, right. And there's no reason to.
Right.
Everybody wins. Everybody benefits from this. There is no downside once I'm able to explain things.
Right.
Now, there are some people who won't like it, some of the secret societies and that kind of thing.
We know what God is going to do with them. We've read the book.
Yeah. That's true.
I mean, excuse my humor, but it's true.
Yeah. Exactly correct, and we win, and they don't, and they're, you know, their things will be frustrated.
That's right.
And even though they think they're in control, God is really in control, both of time and space, and action.
That's
and
right.
Even Satan, read the book of Job in the first two chapters. Even Satan is limited and bound by what God wants done. When he wants it done,
mm-hmm.
Satan is under control, and anything that he does, he is allowed to do.
That's right.
And some people have difficulty with that, but you know that's the way it is. What can I say? God is in control, and prayer changes things. So. Which is a tagline for one radio show, but it certainly is true. God is in control, and prayer does change things.
I can attest to that.
Yeah.
I can bear witness to that. It's true.
You know, most believers can, and even reprobates acknowledge that. You know, those who have once believed and then have, fallen away.
Yeah.
There was a time in which God helped them. Did you ever notice, though, that God helps baby Christians a little bit more than he helps the mature Christians?
Well, of course.
Because they need more help.
That's right.
They need more coddling. And
mm-hmm.
you know, a three-year-old can walk on his own, but a one-and-a-half-year-old needs a little bit of help and a little bit of support. They all still bump into walls, like I like to say, but still. Back to the tomb.
David, do you want to go on to a part two here in yes, 20
yes.
minutes?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, one of the things I will be doing is I will describe one possible method by which the sepulchers can be located even more precisely so that an archaeological excavation can be conducted and the sepulchers can be entered into without damaging the precious writings and the artifacts so that they can be properly preserved, through the Second Coming. So, so far I feel like all we've done is set the stage, but it's actually been necessary to do so. First of all, let me describe King David's unusual burial. And there's an excellent article, a very comprehensive 1948 article by S. Yavin called The Sepulchers of the Kings of the House of David. And this was originally published in the Journal of Near Eastern Studies in Volume 7, Number 30, January, October, pages 30 to 45. There's also another excellent article by Nadav Naaman called The Death Formula and the Burial Place of the Kings of the House of David. And this is in the publication Biblica, Volume 85, 2004, pages 245 to 254. And this entire article is available online, Naaman's article is available online according to the link on the ASK website. But Yavin provides an excellent survey of the subject matter, and he points out that in ancient times, it was very important for person to be buried with their ancestors.
Oh, yes.
And Yavin says, moreover, quote, page 30, moreover, several verses in the Bible not only voice the express desire to be buried in a family tomb, but consider it a special privilege, while failure to be buried with one's ancestors is regarded as a curse and a disaster, end quote. And just to cite briefly, Genesis 47, 29 to 30, Judges chapter 8, verse 32, 2 Samuel chapter 19 and verse 38, those are just three examples of this ancient desire of Israelites to be buried with their ancestors. And failure to do so, like Yavin says, was a curse and a disaster. And Yavin cites Jeremiah 8 and verse 1 and following and Jeremiah 22, verse 18. And it was also important in ancient times that the burial sites be maintained.
Oh, yes.
And this is made clear when Nehemiah approached after the exile, when the Jews had returned to Judah and to Jerusalem, Nehemiah went to the king of Persia with a special request, and he was apparently depressed, and the king of Persia asked him, well, what's your problem? Why are you feeling low? Nehemiah answered in Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 3 and 5, quote, the place of my father's sepulchers lies waste. And then he asks the king, please, send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchers, that I may build it. So it was very important to maintain the tombs of the ancestors. Yavin goes on, after all, King David was not buried with his fathers, although David helped others fulfill their burial customs in 2 Samuel 2:32 and chapter 3, verse 31 and 32, and 2 Samuel 17, verse 23. But David wasn't buried with his ancestors in Bethlehem. He was buried in the city of David. King David even helped rebury the bones of King Saul and his son Jonathan to a more proper grave. This is in 2 Samuel chapter 21, verses 1 to 14. Well, Yavin talks about this, and he says, quote, in page 30 to 31 of the article, yet this same David, who was so loyal to traditional customs, was not buried in his ancestral tomb at Bethlehem, but in a new grave. Quote, it says in the scriptures, citing 1 Kings chapter 2 and verse 10, so David slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. Now, Yavin goes on and says, it is unthinkable that this was done against David's will, or that David left no instructions concerning his burial place. David, who remembered to give Solomon final instructions with regard to his enemies, to David's enemies, surely cannot have forgotten directions concerning the place of his own burial.
Right.
Well, Yavin is absolutely correct.
Right.
David did make provision for his burial. In fact, God made that provision for David's burial, and David acceded to God's desire. Now, I think this would be a good place to break, because now we're going to start talking about the house, King David's house, which
okay.
means the tomb.
Okay. This is George Ann Hughes with David Seeloff, the Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. Please visit the website, askelm.com. You can email David Seeloff, david@askelm.com. And we are moving on right now to part two in our series about King David's tomb. And God bless you all for listening.